Welcome to Conversations on Doing Good, when we talk with leading Asia-based philanthropists and business leaders on their views, strategies, and objectives in investing in the social sector. I am Ruth Shapiro, founder and chief executive of CAPS, the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society. With each conversation, we seek to understand what motivates a philanthropist, why he or she picks the types of projects they do, and what they see as the role of private money in addressing social challenges. In this episode, philanthropist and civic leader Lizzie Zobel de Ayala shares her journey from Colombia to the Philippines, the pressing needs of both societies, and what issues most motivate her. Lizzie, thank you so much for coming and being on this podcast, which is Conversations on Doing Good. You, of course, are on the board of the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society, and for that, I'm very grateful.
Ruth, thank you for having me on your podcast. I think these conversations are so important and ever more urgent today under the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And I think you're doing a great job with the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society.
Thank you. Okay. Well, let's just talk about your life a little bit. You were just going your merry way as a student at Boston College many years ago. You met this fellow, which changed your life fairly dramatically.
Correct.
You are from Colombia and you were going to school in Boston, and I don't think the Philippines was on your radar screen particularly, or am I wrong?
Not at all, Ruth, not at all. I had never even been to Asia when I met Jaime. He was doing his MBA and I was doing my undergraduate degree. I grew up on a farm, actually, Ruth, outside of Cali, Colombia, which is located in a valley in the Andes Mountains. I thought that was where I was going to return to. And when I met Jaime and we decided to have a family, I came to the Philippines. But it's been the most wonderful decision, both personally and professionally. I found so many interesting things in the Philippines. So I'm very happy here. But I think my interest in social investment and social development started on that farm in Cali, Colombia, where I could see the tremendous differences in opportunities that people had depending on the circumstances that they were born into, actually. It's been the same here in the Philippines. So as a young woman, I was interested in social investment, social development. My family had been very interested in the social development of our region in Colombia. And so I think I grew up in a family that was very cognizant of its responsibilities and also the opportunities that we had to change people's lives around us. Colombia and the Philippines are very similar on a social level, economic, political level. So there were many things that I recognized and that I understood intrinsically because of the background that I came from. And so there, I think it was a continuation of something that I'd experienced from a very early age.
But Cali is interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a drug trade there, so people have to make very difficult choices about how they're going to feed their families and what kinds of crops to grow.
Absolutely. It's in the region of the Valle del Cauca, which is where Cali is located, is a very fertile valley, and things grow very, very well there. It's been a sugar region in Colombia and an area of plantations and farms.
Which is similar to the Philippines as well, of course.
It is. And those circumstances really have a way of showing us the differences that people have in accessing the opportunities that they need to be able to move out of this poverty cycle.
So you came to the Philippines and you're part of a
Yes.
family that has for generations found a balance between being part of the community and playing an important leadership role in addressing those differences and being a successful set of businesses in a conglomerate. I think you must have learned a lot about how to find that balance through your marriage and participation in the group that way.
Yes. Well, Ruth, I've the example that Jaime's family has set for myself and for all of us who've had the privilege of watching them work is a beautiful equilibrium between pursuing their business interests and yet attending to the social development interests of the Philippines. And for Jaime, for his siblings, for his parents, it's always been about nation building as well. It's been wonderful to observe it. On my end, I haven't been as involved in the corporate social responsibility angle of Ayala Corporation because I've always thought that belongs to the corporation and the professionals who run it. On my end, I've had my own interest in philanthropy. As you know, reproductive health, reproductive justice has been very important to me. And so has the issue of education quality in teacher training.
Let's discuss both of those. Reproductive health sounds fine if you don't know about where you're coming from. Yes.
The Philippines.
The Philippines, yeah. Which is an extremely Catholic country and ones that took the longest to essentially accept and embrace family planning measures. You started getting involved in reproductive health when it was still a relatively taboo topic.
That's correct, Ruth.
Can you tell us about how did that happen and what kind of pushback did you get?
Well, here I'll take you back to Cali, Colombia and my family. We've been involved in reproductive health, getting women and men access to the family planning services and products that they need to be able to plan their families. Since I was a young woman, I could see in the farm where I lived, the families who had multiple children were struggling to be able to make ends meet and to be able to exit from this poverty cycle. So when I arrived in the Philippines, it was really natural to me. And I came from this sort of very liberal thinking family where this conversation was the most normal conversation. And when I arrived in the Philippines, I realized that the topic of reproductive health and reproductive justice was actually not one that was openly discussed. And I think where we were different, because I came from a Catholic family and I came from a Catholic background, was that this had to do with health and social stability. It had nothing to do with spirituality or going against the church. But in the Philippines, when I was here, I arrived in 87, reproductive health was not a topic that you would have at the dinner table with friends or family. So you're right. But I wasn't so overwhelmed by that pushback because I thought the Filipino women and men need to have access to family planning. In 1998, I joined a group called Friendly Care, and the idea was to create these clinics where people would access general health care for their families, but where the issue of their reproductive health was addressed.
So family planning was integrated into a range of services.
Exactly. Yeah. You could bring your children for pediatric care. If you had a gastric issue, you could come in. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of every session, we'd say, tell us a little bit about your children. How many do you have? What are you doing to address the family planning needs of your family? How can we help you access some of the services and products that you need to be able to plan your family better? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a judgment, Ruth. It was just giving them access to the services and products. This is a model that actually came from Pro Familia in Colombia. It was a very successful Latin American model of setting up these general healthcare clinics all around the country and providing these services together with that. But this is what was happening. We were realizing that we couldn't scale up if we didn't do something at the Department of Health, if we didn't do something that was nationwide, if we didn't engage the government and the legislators in creating a national family planning program, we weren't going to get there quickly enough. And so to get some stability into the population, we needed to be able to legislate for this. And that's when we started working on the reproductive health bill.
That's a big change because there's a general reluctance to want to get involved with policy issues. But it sounds like you had somewhat of an epiphany that unless you did that.
Unless we legislated for a national family planning program, we were going to get nowhere.
And who was we at that point?
I think it was all of us that were interested in family planning. Mm-hmm. Some of us were doctors, some of us were public health officials, some of us had been former secretaries of health, secretaries of finance. Some of us had been demographers. Some of us came from the private sector like myself. Some of us were just advocates like me. I had no experience in medicine, legislation, but I did believe in the importance of this topic. I remember being around a table with a whole bunch of men and women and discussing what the reproductive health bill would look like and what words would be used. And that took a few years. That was in 1998 when that discussion started. Mm-hmm. And the reproductive health bill was passed in December of 2012.
Wow.
14 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And 14 years where it must have been a little bit of a roller coaster. You probably thought at times you were close, at times you were further away.
Exactly.
And it's a topic that's very much wrapped up in politics.
We were trying many times to understand how it had gotten entangled. Ruth, I was never of the belief that one should fight the church on this,
mm-hmm.
because I think the church has a position. It has a right to have that position. What I was struggling with is why was the government allowing the position of one religious institution to inform their public health policy? So it was the government and the legislators that I was addressing. The church is free to have its own position, and that's fine with me. I have no issue. We may disagree, but I have no issue with the church. But I do mm-hmm. have issue with government allowing itself to inform public health policies.
The Philippines, of course, was one of the last, countries in the world. It was the last,
correct.
Right?
It was the last. And Ruth, I have to say something. We've had two women presidents in the Philippines
right.
who haven't been able to do this. And it took a bachelor president to use his political capital to pass the reproductive health bill. And I always like to say that because I think it's kind of ironic.
Well, I mean, there's a whole theory about Nixon going to China, right? Sometimes it does take someone who you wouldn't think is aligned to really be the one to stop the bottleneck or to push the
exactly.
bottleneck. Since 2012,
yeah.
it's been almost a decade. Would you say that the problem is not
You've made
solved?
It No, yeah. It's not. But it's improved tremendously. The contraceptive acceptance rate in the Philippines has increased. The infant mortality rates have decreased. The maternity mortality rates have decreased. And so has the population growth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've made inroads. I think there are more women today in the Philippines accessing the family planning methods that they need and they want. They're being able to make the choices with more information. But yes, it's far from over. At the local government level, there's been a lot of pushback on the implementation of the reproductive health programs. There's been pushback also in incorporating reproductive health and reproductive justice into the curriculum at the Department of Education. There's a lot to be done, but I think we've achieved a little bit more than we had before.
You are listening to Conversations on Doing Good, a podcast series put on by CAPS, the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society. You became increasingly involved and interested in education, or was that true from the beginning as well?
I think it was part of my interest in family planning because I think that educated women and men make choices for themselves. And it's proven again and again that the greatest arbiter, or how would you call it?
The most influential factor in these choices is education of
correct.
The woman.
Exactly. And so I became interested in education in the Philippines. I've been working for over 20 years in the field of education. First, we started out with a program to train teachers to create functional, literate community. That was really valuable. And we worked with the Department of Education for many years training teachers, enjoyed the work tremendously, but realized that at the crux of all of this lay the fact that some of the choices that were being made, some of the policies that were being made at the Department of Education lacked a grounding with what was actually happening on the field. What we were experiencing on the field training teachers was quite different to some of the decisions that were being made at the Department of Education's headquarters. And we wondered, how could we bridge this so that the programs would be grounded on the reality and an understanding of the obstacles that existed on the ground? And increasingly, I became interested in Teach for America. They would bring their resourcefulness, their grit into these classrooms and create sense of possibilities for these children who have, in many cases, lost a sense of direction, hope, different future for themselves. But long term, what Teach for America was proving was that these teachers who had gone into these under-resourced communities had changed themselves. And most of them were not moving on to other careers. They were actually deciding to stay in education and find ways to provide leadership in education.
And is that happening in the Philippines with Teach for the Philippines?
Yes, yes. We're really quite astounded by how our teacher fellows at the end of their two-year contract, 73% are choosing to stay in education. And our network, Teach for the Philippines is the 25th country to enter, I believe, the network. And now there are over 50 countries around the world. And across the network, 50 to 53%, depending on the year, stay in education. In the Philippines, we're experiencing 73%. And they're actually working in senators' offices as technical assistants. They're working in congressmen's office and local government units' offices. They're working at the DepEd Central Office, at the Department of Education Central Office. They're working for all sorts of educational initiatives around the country. Some have decided to stay inside the classroom, and some are pursuing leadership positions in their schools. So it's
That's very exciting. It is, because we know that teachers are the most important factor in a child's schooling. If you have a great teacher, it makes all the difference.
All the difference. And investing in their professional development is very important. Mentoring is very important. And I think that that's something that we're trying to do at Teach for the Philippines, this idea that we need to constantly train our teachers and invest in their professional development, because we can take a good teacher and make her into a, or him into a great teacher.
And you stay connected to the alumni of Teach for the Philippines, is that right?
That's correct. We have a wonderful alumni network. They meet regularly, connect with each other so that they can leverage the different positions they're in and use each other to try and create a larger impact in what they're doing.
For decades around the world, the profession of teaching lost some of its patina, its prestige. I actually have this theory that because women didn't have that many career options, smart women, in effect, subsidized the teaching profession.
Yeah.
But now a lot of smart women have many options. Teaching is just one of them.
Correct.
So we need to get really talented men and women into the profession and to have them look at it anew as an attractive career path. Do you see that happening?
Yes. Well, you know, Ruth, it's interesting. At Teach for the Philippines, we have had tremendous success recruiting. I think one of the beautiful things of this generation, or the generation they call the millennials, is that they're choosing to leave school, and a lot of them want to have jobs that have a bigger purpose, a bigger societal purpose. They're looking for meaning in their work. They're looking for happiness in their work. And a lot of that happiness comes from a sense of fulfillment, of fulfilling this dream they have to create a change in their country, to create a change for society. So we're being able to recruit some very, very talented young men and women that would traditionally go and work for HSBC or for these great companies and receive these incredible salaries. And they're choosing not to. A lot of them are choosing to look for employment in things like Teach for the Philippines and many other NGOs like ours, because we're not the only one that is doing this effort to improve quality in education in the Philippines. There are many, many incredible organizations here. I'll tell you, Ruth, we were shocked. One of the great universities in the Philippines, Ateneo Jesuit University, does this survey for incoming seniors. What are the top 10 companies that you would like to work for? And we've been at the top of their survey for a few years now.
That's terrific. That's a real sign of success.
Yes, yes.
I mean, more success for Teach for the Philippines, but more importantly, as we were saying, just for the bringing back the attractiveness of teaching as the career path, as a life choice.
A lot of friends in my generation, when they speak about their mother or their father being a teacher, they speak with tremendous pride, because in the Philippines, to be a teacher was a very important profession in the small towns, in the large cities, and a public school teacher was a very prestigious thing. And now, when we ask teachers what they do, they say, oh, I'm teacher lang, which means, oh, I'm just a teacher.
Right.
And that tells us that story of the sort of deterioration in the social perception of the profession of teaching. And that's something that we're working on also at Teach for the Philippines.
Right. It's so it's unfortunate, because if you think about the importance of teaching children who become the leaders and citizens at a conceptual level, at a cerebral level, there's really no question that parenting and teaching are extremely important, and yet both of them receive short shrift in terms of societal recognition.
Absolutely, Ruth. Absolutely. Both parenting and a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad is not as prestigious as a president of a bank or something like that. And yet they're doing the heavy lifting, and they're creating the people with the values and the imagination to create a better future for us. Yeah.
Right there. No, it's absolutely integral. So let me just ask you, in terms of those values, obviously your four children came into a world filled with opportunity. And I imagine that you and Jaime must have thought about how you're going to make sure that you instill important values in them and keep them grounded. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When I think about parenting my children and Jaime and I think we lived more by example, Ruth. In other words, I think what our kids picked up was less awareness, I think, of their circumstances, and more about being productive members of a community. And it could be a small community like the village we live in, or it could be a larger idea such as the Philippines or the region. And I think that our discussions were more around that than they were around our personal circumstances. Does that make sense?
Yes, but I also think that you model kindness and compassion in an extraordinary way. So the things that you're involved in that you shared with them, and the way that you treat people are very important.
I think what I tried to tell the children is that it's not what you say or you speak about, but it's more about what you do and your actions that speak about what you value and what's important to you.
So we're having this conversation at a time of a global crisis. You've been under lockdown for 3 months, is it?
That's correct. Right. We've been under lockdown. Now it's a generalized quarantine. It's not like a rock solid lockdown. I can actually leave my house. I have some liberties now that I didn't have. And that began on June 1.
Now, my view about COVID-19 is that it hasn't so much changed the world as much as it has accelerated certain trends that were starting anyway.
Yeah.
One of them is the view about a person's role and a corporation's role in society. I think there's increased awareness of everyone needing to engage and have involvement in the communities around them. Do you see that?
Absolutely.
That change happening?
I think we're going to see it. I think we have less evidence of that change in attitude because right now we're focusing all our efforts on this COVID response. This is absolutely inevitable. I think those of us who were not spending as much time thinking about our social investments or the urgency of these social investments, I think all of us are waking up to that. The economic impact of the coronavirus crisis is making itself felt right now. And I think it's forcing everyone to think about the way that they can make a difference to those that are being affected.
I think that there's a number of people who you didn't hear from, but are much more comfortable telling the world, we're engaged and here's what we're doing. I do think that the people are stepping up and that is part of the story they want to tell about themselves, which is very positive.
Yes, I think it's a very positive thing. I'm sorry that the circumstances are so difficult for so many. The little silver lining here may be that there's a change in attitude about people's responsibilities to society. Everyone has a right to invest in the ways that matter to them and in the issues that matter to them or the issues they find are going to have the biggest impact in society. But I think what you're doing at CAPS is extraordinary because you're keeping this discussion alive and you're making sure that people are using their investment to have the greatest impact.
I think that's true, that philanthropy really emanates from your own experience. What's extraordinary in the world right now is that we have this global shared experience. So it's a time where I've been feeling that there's cognition that it's a time for all hands on deck.
Correct.
I'm starting to see how we can come out of this stronger and better and more sustainable and more equitable. And so it's very useful. And at CAPS, I think we need to help provide tools and understanding of how that's going to happen. Thank you. And we appreciate all the time you spend with CAPS and on this podcast.
Oh, Ruth, thank you. I have really enjoyed our conversation. And I'll be happy to listen to our conversation through the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conversations on Doing Good. Please follow our conversations wherever you get your podcasts or through the CAPS website at caps.org.